it's John Dennis on Monday the 11th of May. Today, thousands more terrified civilians have poured out of Pakistan's Swat Valley during a lull in fighting between the army and the Taliban.
Over the last number of days, the Pakistan army has been using its warplanes, helicopter gunships and artillery to inflict as much damage as possible on Taliban defensive positions.
Also today, revelations about MPs' expenses threaten to engulf more politicians, and Barack Obama's stand-up comedy routine.
I am Barack Obama. Most of you covered me. All of you voted for me. Apologies to the Fox table.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the headlines and the papers with Sue Mansfield.
Reports claim at least 378 people have been killed by fierce shelling from the Sri Lankan army in the past 24 hours. The army denies shelling the designated safe zone for civilians and blames any deaths on Tamil Tiger rebels. The UN said today this was the bloodbath the international community had long feared would take place. The attack marks the bloodiest assault on ethnic Tamil civilians since the civil war flared again more than 3 years ago. Conservative leader David Cameron says MPs must say sorry over controversial expense claims as the focus of leaked claims turns towards his own party. He said MPs had to admit the system was wrong and were sorry about it. The Daily Telegraph reported that Tory MP Alan Duncan recouped £7,000 for gardening costs over 3 years, including a ride-on lawnmower. Plans for an independent auditing body for claims are expected later today. General David Petraeus has announced a review into the American use of airstrikes in Afghanistan. The head of US Central Command said tactical actions should not undermine strategic goals. His comments came after Afghan President Hamid Karzai said US airstrikes that kill civilians were damaging the fight against terrorism. Sport now, and Jenson Button's superb season continued as he won the Spanish Grand Prix yesterday, beating his teammate Rubens Barrichello into second. This was Button's fourth Formula One win of the season out of five races. And in football, Manchester United moved a step closer to retaining the Premier League title after beating their rivals Manchester City. Cristiano Ronaldo and Carlos Tevez struck as the home side eased to victory. Now for a look at the papers, and the Daily Mail says MPs are in line for a multi-million pound windfall even when they leave the Commons. The sale of taxpayer-funded second homes will ensure those retiring at the next election will pocket large sums of pure profit. The Times leads on the Middle East and King Abdullah of Jordan's ultimatum of peace now or it's war next year. The paper says the Obama administration is pushing for a comprehensive peace agreement to settle Israel's conflict with Palestine, Syria and Lebanon. King Abdullah said if Mr. Obama didn't make good his promise for peace, his credibility would evaporate overnight. And the Daily Express says thousands of lives would be saved from cancer each year if people simply lost weight. A study reveals 19,000 cancer deaths every year are due to obesity. And there's more news and breaking stories throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
In Pakistan's Swat Valley, fighting erupted last week after the collapse of a peace deal between the government and the Taliban. Pakistan's military is now stepping up its campaign to dislodge the Taliban, in particular from the regional capital, Mingora. Yesterday, the army temporarily relaxed a curfew to enable civilians to escape the fighting. Tens of thousands of residents have now fled, as Declan Walsh reports from Islamabad.
Tens of thousands of people fled from the main town, Mingora, down towards the neighbouring districts of Mardan and Swabi. That's where most of the refugees have been congregating. And the camps there are filling up very quickly. I've just been speaking to an official with the UNHCR who says that the two earlier camps in Mardan are now full, and they're starting to redirect people into other areas. There are eight camps currently welcoming refugees from the Swat and surrounding areas, and the numbers are just skyrocketing. I mean, the UN had predicted 500,000 people would be displaced by this conflict. The way things are going at the moment, it looks like that figure will be reached and probably exceeded.
And what about the fighting itself? I mean, there's been intense fighting in Mingora.
That's right. I mean, during the break in curfew, there was also a lull in the fighting that allowed people to leave. But basically, over the last number of days, the Pakistan Army has been using its warplanes, helicopter gunships and artillery to inflict as much damage as possible on Taliban defensive positions, particularly in Mingora city. Mingora at the moment is effectively controlled by the Taliban. The government just has one or two small outposts in the city. And what appears to be happening is that the army is trying to soften up those defensive positions as much as possible to prepare for a possible ground assault in the coming days.
Is there any precedent for this kind of warfare in modern Pakistan?
No, this is very unusual in terms of the fight against the Taliban. Until now, the Pakistan army has mostly been fighting in remote mountainous areas, mostly in the tribal belt. This is one of the first major military operations in what you might call mainstream Pakistan. It's in the northwest frontier province, which is close to the tribal belt, but is subject to the normal laws of the land. The other point is that Mingora is a built-up city, and this is probably the first time, you know, since the war against the Taliban has started, that the militants have tried to hold any sort of sizable urban centre. They've been laying mines all around Mingora. They have planted explosives under bridges. They have fighters with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades positioned on rooftops in strategic locations across Mingora. So they seem to be preparing for a very serious bout of urban combat whenever the army does decide to send in its ground troops.
And Pakistan's Prime Minister has said that the army was now fighting for the survival of the country. I mean, is that over-egging it, or is it as serious as that?
There's certainly a degree of political rhetoric in that. What Yousaf Reza Gilani was trying to do is to rally public support behind him. The background to it, John, is that until perhaps 3 or 4 weeks ago, you know, the Pakistani public was slightly ambivalent on this whole issue of fighting the Taliban. There was very much a sense here that the Pakistan military was fighting what people saw as America's war. A couple of things have changed since then. Most notably, a peace deal with Taliban in Swat collapsed. Even though the government caved into their demand of imposing Islamic law, the Taliban used their stronghold in Swat to start pushing into adjoining areas like Deer and Bunare. And that seems to have had a very profound effect on public opinion. So what Yousaf Reza Gilani, the Prime Minister, is trying to do is to solidify that opinion. Until now, the media have been very firmly behind this action. So has the political opposition and the religious parties, who have traditionally had a soft spot for the Taliban, have been at the very least muted. The question going forward is how long this consensus can last, because as this humanitarian situation exacerbates, both in the refugee camps and for those people who are still trapped in SWAT as the fighting goes on, the uniformity of public opinion is certainly going to be challenged.
Declan Walsh, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/Pakistan. Also on the Guardian's website, this week we're running a series of suggestions for budget dinners by top chefs. Today, Delia Smith starts us off with two recipes, dinner for a fiver at guardian.co.uk/food. Essential reading for David Cameron, how not to get your bike nicked. Easier said than done, of course. guardian.co.uk/G2. And the psychotherapist Susie Orbach, author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, is interviewed by Decca Aitkenhead at guardian.co.uk/women. Today, MPs return to the Commons for the first time since details of their expenses were leaked to the Daily Telegraph. We've had a slew of revelations, some trivial, some much more serious. We've learned that John Prescott claimed for two toilet seats. Tourism Minister Barbara Follett spent £25,000 of our money on personal security. Five Sinn Féin MPs received £500,000 in second homes allowances despite not taking up their seats in the House. And Hazel Blears, the Communities Secretary, had a London flat registered with the Inland Revenue as her primary residence that allowed her to escape paying £18,000 in tax when selling it, but she had the same property registered with Commons authorities as her second home, which meant that she could claim back thousands of pounds in mortgage interest and running costs. In Westminster, our chief political correspondent is Nicholas Watt.
In many ways, it's the claims that are for not a huge amount of money that just seem to strike a chord and everybody really notices. So it's the claim for the Kit Kat. It's the claim for the 5p carrier bag. And on Sunday, there was this very interesting revelation that James Gray, a Conservative MP, a former front bencher, had charged £60 for wreaths that he laid in his constituency. He said, "I had to go to three different ceremonies. They were £20 each, therefore I was out of pocket by £60. Other people, obviously critics, would say, well, surely if you go to lay a wreath, probably that money's going towards the British Legion, surely you should want to pay that for yourself. So yes, it's the small things like that that are really hitting home. But then, as you say, there are significant elements. And I think the most significant thing that we've learnt in the last 3 to 4 days from what the Daily and Sunday Telegraph have been publishing is this so-called flipping of homes. That is that under the system, MPs have to say to the Commons authorities what their main residence is and what their second residence is. And the reason for that is that it's widely accepted because MPs work both at Parliament in their constituencies, they need two homes and the state should pay for one of them. The significance there is that the second home that they declare, they are then entitled to claim under the additional costs allowance for that, for rent on that, for mortgage interest and for furniture. And what the Telegraph have shown is that MPs are flipping and they're saying one for a few months, that's my first home, for a few months, that's my second home. And what that means they can do is they can buy furniture for one house or I'm going to flip it and then I can buy furniture for the other. Now, if the Daily Telegraph had not done this investigation, we wouldn't have known about that, because when these expenses were meant to come out in July, the addresses of the MPs would have been redacted on the grounds of security. Fair enough, you can say that MPs need security, but equally we would not have known about that flipping, and I think that's pretty significant.
So far, not surprisingly, Nick, it seems to be Labour that suffered the most political damage from this.
Well, the Daily Telegraph has faced criticism, and most notably on Friday from Lord Mandelson, who said this is a Conservative-supporting paper that is making its main line of attack on Labour, therefore this is politically motivated. And the Telegraph have said, hold on, hold your horses, this is going to last some time, this is going to run over a few days, and yes, we will concentrate our fire on the Conservatives. And indeed today they are focusing on the Shadow Cabinet with more embarrassing details. And so from the Daily Telegraph's point of view, they will be saying, we told you it would be everyone, and here we are, Monday, it is everyone.
There's some senior politicians involved in these allegations, including Gordon Brown himself. But his sister-in-law, the Prime Minister's sister-in-law, writes in The Guardian today, Nick.
Well, that's right. This investigation started out on Thursday night with the Daily Telegraph focusing on 13 members of the Shadow Cabinet, most notably Gordon Brown, picture on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. And the point that they were making, and they thought this was hugely embarrassing to the Prime Minister, was that he'd paid between £5,000 to £6,000 to his brother Andrew for a cleaner. And the Daily Telegraph said that didn't look terribly good. And we've got a piece by Claire Brown, who's married to Andrew Brown, the Prime Minister's brother, saying, look, this is not only very very innocent, it actually shows how Gordon Brown absolutely does things by the book. And what Claire Brown says in the piece is that, you know, in the mid-1990s, Gordon Brown's focus was on politics. It was on writing speeches, on writing big policy documents. It wasn't on having his flat cleaned. So brother Andrew said, come on, Gordon, we've got to sort this out, and said, I'm going to sort you out with a cleaner. And Gordon Brown said, well, that's all very well. You can sort me out with a cleaner, but we've got to do this by the book. And so they drew up a contract. Who's drawn up a contract with their cleaner, which specified the cleaner's hours? It specified the cleaner's wages. It said, we're going to pay your tax, we're going to pay your national insurance, you're going to have paid holiday, you're going to have all sorts of rights. Not many people do that with their cleaners. So here we are, Gordon Brown doing it absolutely scrupulously. And the point that Claire Brown is making is that this was all pointed out to the Daily Telegraph, but they didn't choose to focus on this. They're not giving these MPs any quarter. And the critics are saying that's unfair and not very balanced reporting.
Nick Watt. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, Silvio Berlusconi says a multi-ethnic Italy is not an option. But first, a group of Kenyan Mau Mau rebels who say they were tortured by British officers during colonial rule are taking their battle for compensation from the UK government to the British courts. Zan Rice is in Nairobi. He explains what happened to them.
It's not something the UK government acknowledges, but it's certainly something that historians have documented increasingly in recent years. There's been a couple of books, including one which won the Pulitzer Prize by Caroline Elkins, documenting in detail what happened to these people. And one of the difficulties that they've had along the time is, and one of the reasons it's taken so long to come out, is that the Mau Mau was only unbanned in Kenya in 2003. So until then, it was very difficult for people to even tell their stories of what had happened to them.
Well, now the Mau Mau veterans are seeking compensation from the UK government in the British courts.
That's right. On the 23rd of June, a lawsuit is going to be launched in London by the London lawyers Lee Day and Co. on behalf of the Kenya Human Rights Commission and the Mau Mau Veterans Association and here in Nairobi, and they're going to be launching the case on behalf of five claimants, two women and three men in their 70s and 80s, who say they suffered abuses at the hands of the British. And depending on how that initial claim goes, hundreds or potentially thousands of people could be attached to the class action suit.
And do we know yet what the British government will do in response to this lawsuit?
Well, they will fight it vigorously because, I mean, if they lose this one, it could open the floodgates for other claims in colonial history around the world. I mean, what they've said to the lawyers so far is, first of all, you're out of time. You know, it's more than 50 years on. You should have brought this earlier. And second of all, they say the colonial obligations transferred to the Kenyan government at independence. So, in fact, Britain has got, no obligation for what, or no liability for what happened under their rule. So this will be a real test case for the courts.
Is there still widespread anger in Kenya about what happened to the Mau Mau?
There is anger. Whether it's widespread, I'm not sure. But there certainly is anger of people of a certain generation. And, you know, the Kenya, as I said, the Mau Mau was only unbanned here in 2003. And the Kenyan governments, successive governments, have not exactly been particularly sympathetic to Mau Mau veterans, because Mau Mau was, a lot of Kenyans were killed by the Mau Mau rebels as well. So it's a bit of a sensitive issue here. But there certainly is, you know, widespread knowledge that there was abuse by the British. I guess there is a lingering anger that Britain hasn't at least apologised for what went on.
And even Barack Obama's own grandfather was detained during this period by the British government.
Well, that's right. It seems he was falsely imprisoned for 6 months by the British. And there's a lot of those cases. In fact, two of the claimants that are going to appear before court, hopefully on June the 23rd, never even took the Mau Mau oath. They were just rounded up, suspected by the British, and held in prison for years. So yeah, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people rounded up, and many of them weren't actually Mau Mau.
Zan Rice. Last week, the United Nations called on the Italian government to guarantee the rights of asylum seekers after Italy turned away boatloads of African migrants at sea and sent them directly back to Libya. But the Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who faces a storm over his wife's claim that he goes out with minors, provoked further outrage when he defended his immigration policy. As John Hooper reports from Rome.
He was answering questions about the government's immigration policy after a row that broke out after Italian naval vessels escorted back to Libya more than 200 immigrants, boat people, who had been trying to enter Italy. And he said at one point that the left had an idea, which was that of a multi-ethnic Italy. Our idea isn't like that, he said.
And what's been the reaction to his comments?
Well, there has been predictably an outcry on the left. People saying that Italy is already multi-ethnic. You can't turn the clock back. 7% of the Italian population now is made up of immigrants. And in any case, if you go far enough back in history, it is indeed multi-ethnic, because there are German speakers, for example, there are French speakers, there are people of Slavic origin also in various parts of Italy.
I mean, this is part of a general kind of move on the part of Silvio Berlusconi's coalition government to position itself as a sort of anti-immigration political force.
Yes, indeed. It's something that has been characteristic of the government right from the beginning, because it was elected on a law and order ticket, and it has consistently stressed the link between crime in Italy and illegal immigrants. The figures show that a disproportionate amount of crime is indeed committed by illegal immigrants. But once they become legal immigrants, that correlation breaks down completely, and what you have is a situation in which the legal immigrants commit neither more nor less crime than the Italians themselves.
Meanwhile, John, Silvio Berlusconi has been defending himself against a range of allegations from his estranged wife about his relations with women and even young girls.
Yes, indeed, he has, though he's not going to have to probably defend himself that very much more for much longer, because the polls at the moment indicate that he has not been seriously damaged by this, though quite interestingly they do show that a majority of Italians want decent standards from their leaders. I think that a lot will now depend on how long and how sordid this whole divorce proceedings are, and how much more information comes out about Mr. Berlusconi's private life.
How do you account for his continued popularity in the polls, John? Because if such allegations happen to a leading British politician, you know, it's hard to imagine them carrying on.
Well, by and large, Italians do not ascribe as much importance to the private behaviour of their politicians as do Britons and others, Americans particularly. What the figures show is that somewhere between 40 and 50% say that they really don't care at all, and that between 50 and 60% say that they would like to have decent standards from people. But when it's applied to Mr. Berlusconi, the figure was 77% said that they really weren't going to be influenced by what had happened in recent days.
John Hooper. The White House Correspondents' Association has hosted a black tie dinner attended by Barack Obama. As our Washington correspondent Ewan McCaskill explains, the president had his fellow guests rolling in the aisles.
Which brings me to another thing that's changed in this new, warmer, fuzzier White House. And that's my relationship with Hillary. You know, we had been rivals during the campaign, but these days we could not be closer. In fact, the second she got back from Mexico, she pulled me into a hug and gave me a big kiss.
It's the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. It's a sort of gathering of about 2,500 journalists, politicians, and lots of celebrities from Los Angeles, from the sort of film world. So it's a big bash, but it's the sort of Washington equivalent of the Oscars.
And it's traditional for the president to tell a few gags.
Well, it is, but normally it's a very sort of staid, almost embarrassing affair. I mean, especially, I mean, George Bush wasn't particularly good at jokes. Clinton wasn't bad, but most of them tend to be very poor. You know, it's sort of forced humour. People tend to applaud and sporadic laughter just because it's present, but normally it's a very embarrassing affair. But not on this occasion. Obama sort of showed that he had the sort of timing and good gags of you know, lots of sort of stand-up comics. There's lots of stand-up comedy locations around DC, and Obama wouldn't have been out of place in any of them.
It can't do any harm to Barack Obama's relations with the press.
He sent up the press. He made a joke about quite a sensitive issue about there's lots of accusations that the US media were sort of cheerleaders for Obama. So he made a joke about that. But the good thing about it was that he spent most of the time sending himself up. It was a pretty edgy performance, but a lot of the barbs were aimed at himself, and I think that went down well.
I may not agree with everything you write or report. I may even complain, or more likely Gibbs will complain, from time to time about how you do your jobs. But I do so with the knowledge that when you are at your best, then you help me be at my best. You help all of us who serve at the pleasure of the American people do our jobs better by holding us accountable, by demanding honesty, by preventing us from taking shortcuts and falling into easy political games that people are so desperately weary of.
Phil Maynard and Ian Chambers produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.